This talk was given by Vanessa Zuise Goddard Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Zuise Sensei is a lay teacher in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is our third Buddhist Studies session on the Jataka Tales. So let me give a little bit of background first. The term Jataka means birth history, and it is, as you know, a collection of the stories that are said to have happened before the Buddha's birth as Siddhartha Gautama, and that also record his movement from bodhisattvahood to Buddhahood and full enlightenment. And so they, in that sense, they also are a kind of record of a progression of a spiritual life. Of course, a very particular spiritual life in this case, but it also show his development and his perfection, if you will, his perfection of virtue especially. And they are part of the Pali Canon, which is divided into three different baskets. The Vinaya Pitaka, which is the rules, the monastic code. The Sutra, the rules of discipline, really. The Sutra Pitaka, words of the Buddha. All of the various sutras that were taken down after his death. And the Abhidharma Pitaka, which organizes and reworks the teachings that are contained in the sutras. And the Jatakas are included in the last of five collections or Nikayas that are in the Sutra Pitaka. And they're actually a little bit of an eclectic collection of all the texts that are not included in the other in the other four collections. And so the Therigata, you know, the poems by the nuns, the Theragata, the poems by monastics, by the monks, and the Dhammapada are also part of this fifth Nikaya. And these stories really make up probably the earliest Buddhist literature. And there's said to be about 550 Jataka tales that date back as early as the 4th century before the Common Era, and that continued to be developed actually up until the 19th century, some kind of more modern versions of them. So this really means that they were starting to be developed probably first orally transmitted and then written down very shortly after the Buddha's death. And they highlight, you know, quintessential Buddhist qualities, especially the paramitas, patience, selflessness, generosity, very, very much selflessness and an emphasis on compassion, especially as they are collected in the Mahayana literature. And, you know, like any good story, they present, you know, a set of characters. The Buddha is sometimes appears as himself. Very often he appears as an animal or as another character. And there's a conflict whose resolution rests on the practice and the development of one of the virtues. And, you know, I've always thought that stories are the way that we make sense of ourselves and we make sense of the world. And so they both shape and reflect our experience. And in this case, they very much provide an example, an inspiration for practice, guidance, and they have power. Roshi has been speaking about the power of narrative. And these narratives as myth, he also spoke about mythos and logos as myth, they're intended to give not facts, but meaning, right? To provide meaning, kind of overarching meaning, universal meaning, to point to the patterns of the best way to live a human life. And some of the early Jataka tales were written in the first batch, if you will, was written in Pali, and then they later move into Sanskrit. And you can see, if you read them, you can see the development. The Pali stories tend to be kind of rougher. It's just the bare setting, the characters, the problem, the resolution, the moral of the story. And as they move into the Mahayana literature, they become more and more elaborate as stories themselves. And the language takes on more of a role in the very telling of the story. And in general, it is said that it was the Buddha himself. He's the one who tells the story. So they often, as the ones that Roshi picked here, there's a kind of an introduction where the Buddha is teaching his monks, and he wants to illustrate a particular point, and so he then tells himself one of the stories of one of his past lives. And Rafe Martin, in his collection, speaks of the influence that these Jatakas have had really over the now thousands of years on Western literature, you know, from Aesop's Fables, Arabian Nights, Shakespeare, Kipling. And I have found folk tales and fairy tales, you know, in the Germanic or English, British traditions that are almost identical to some of these early Jatakas. And so you could say, you know, that a good story never gets old and is in fact universal, and that so many of these are really translatable from culture to culture. I do think on the downside that many of these tales, you know, tend toward, especially later on, they tend toward the moralistic. And early on, they highlight the asceticism of the early yogic traditions in India. And they kind of present a kind of a virtue that is saintly. You know, so you have to kind of tease out, you know, some of the more human elements. And still, there's the couple, the Rhys Davids, Caroline and T.W., were Sanskrit scholars, I believe, and they collected and translated and commented on a number of these. And she says of them, "For all the foolishness we find in the Jatakas, the oddities, the inconsistencies, the many distortions in ideals and in the quest of them, they are collectively the greatest epic in literature of the ascent of humanity, the greatest ballad book on the theme that humans willing the better become the better. We are given the life history of the individual, not as a type, but as a human unit with a long life history of their own." And Rafe Martin says, you know, that stories are always true because they are true to the imagination in which they live. And so the purpose, I would say, of these particular stories is really to encourage a deep inner change, deep transformation. And so we have here these three that Roshi selected. And I wrote him actually to ask him why he had selected these particular ones. They're not the most well-known ones. The second one, the pregnant doe, is also named the Banyan deer, better known as the Banyan deer, really. You know, they're not the most well-known, but he didn't remember why he had chosen these particular ones. He said he just wanted to give a selection, and he didn't have them in front of him. So this is what we have. So I have stuff, you know, that I pulled out, and I was just going to focus on these since this is what I assume everybody read. And so I have some stuff, but what would you like to bring out? Or we can just sit here looking at each other. Yes, Eve. Do we have mics?
So I just had a question. I noticed that, like, a lot of them, the end, like, identification of who everybody was often this character Devadatta appears as the Buddha's kind of like interlocutor in some cases, like enemy in this story. So I was just curious, like, I don't know, like in the Buddha's lifetime as the Buddha, who Devadatta was and what their relationship was, because it seems to be kind of like so many of these stories seem to be trying to explain their current relationship, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yes, because it's a long-standing, conflictive relationship. So he was said to be the Buddha's cousin. And apparently it's in this one, in the Traders of Sariva, that this, it's really jealousy. It's Devadatta is deeply, deeply jealous of the Buddha's authority and spiritual power. And so from very early on, we actually have stories that we've done with the kids that speak of the Buddha's life and speak of Devadatta seeing the Buddha teach and seeing, again, the power, the authority that he has, and wanting, not the Dharma, but wanting that. He really wanted that power. And so he plots in many different ways against the Buddha's life, and he reappears over and over again in these stories as I also see him as the counterpart. So he's the one who's greedy and selfish and self-centered and not compassionate at all, and then the Buddha appears and counteracts that. And there's one of my favorite Jatakas, Nalagiri, that we did with the kids earlier this year. Nalagiri the elephant. Devadatta basically makes this raging elephant angry with the help of these bunch of guys with spears to trample the Buddha. And in the moment of this kind of big confrontation, the Buddha stops him by the power of his loving kindness. And Devadatta, seeing this, almost, it says, so Nalagiri kneels down at the Buddha's feet and he puts his head down and basically becomes completely tame and in a sense bows before the Buddha. And seeing this, Devadatta is this close to doing the same. He has this impulse to go and prostrate himself before the Buddha's feet and just basically say, okay, you know, teach me. And he turns away. He kind of slinks back into the shadows. So I think part of the purpose of these stories, as I said, because it's the Buddha teaching his monastics, his assembly, he's making a point of, I was this person here, or I was this the animal or whatever, and this were the other characters, and this is how we were all related, and through all of these lifetimes, we continue. So there's this theme of, oh yes, I was the refuge in the pregnant doe, I was the refuge in a previous life, let me tell you that story. So that these relationships, you have this sense, continue over time, and the karma, I don't know if Devadatta actually ever changes. So you can see the karma just continues because he's unwilling to change.
That is one of the things that makes the Jataka tales interesting to me, is this, like, the idea of the transformation of karma. But I get, I was feeling a little bit like, oh yeah, at the end of every story, like, of course, Buddha's like the hero again. And I kind of was like, you know, where are the stories where Buddha shows, like, you know, this time I blew it, and from that I learned, and that's why now I da da da. Or like Devadatta, like,
I'm gonna write those. I'm gonna write those.
Okay.
That's a great idea.
That sounds great. You know, and Devadatta, like, he never turns. And so I just wondered what you make of, you know, because these are instructional materials. Like, why lock everybody in? Like, why not paint more of an evolution over time?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have an answer. I mean, you know, one thing that I thought was that, you know, at a certain point, I mean, there's 550 of them, and apparently they're arranged, a lot of them are written in verse, and they're arranged like the Tarigata by the number of verses. And, you know, at a certain point, they become kind of formulaic. You have the three or four animals, and you have the conflict, and the Buddha comes in and saves the day. And so, you know, at a certain point, I just wonder if they did become kind of formulaic. I think, they're also a product of their time. The second one, I hadn't read the full version. I had read Banyan Deer several times, but it didn't have the whole first part with the nun. And, I mentioned this last week. She's never named. She's never named, right? So everybody else in the story is named. The Buddha is named, Devadatta, Ananda. Is there anybody else? The two king deers, deer kings, are named. She is never named. She's the girl, the wife, the nun, the mother, the doe. That really gets to me. and if you read the story, this one I must admit, had a lot of trouble with. Her whole kind of trajectory is decided by the males around her. By her husband who says, yeah, okay, go ahead and become ordained, by Devadatta sending her basically to trial, even by the Buddha saying, well, I can't just do this on my own. Let's basically have a trial. And then the deer kings, same thing with the doe. And so, I wrote here at one point, the Buddha says, I was the refuge of these two. Even her fawn is named as Kashyapa, and she's not. And so the Buddha says, I was a refuge of these two in a previous life. And I wrote to myself, well, it would have been great if she could have been her own refuge, And so basically, I don't have an answer, but I think some of it is also, they're a product of their time and their culture. And Rafe Martin he's written a few kind of modern jatakas. I don't know if he didn't say this. Hopefully some of it is just to break out of that. But he's also following a particular kind of style, that these have.
I wonder if this relates to your comment about the fact that these tales seem moralistic at times. That I always have seen the Jataka tales, not because I don't really... I'm not attracted to the idea of rebirth. I more see them as the present selves. And so I think of that moralistic part as being something that can be turned to in times of need. And in terms of...
Can you give an example?
Oh, well, I think more of it as being like Buddha nature. So that's the reason it's always the hero. It's the constant. And in the Banyan Deer, I see that unnamed feminine as mystery and darkness and depth. And I wonder if the effort always to give that aspect more presence isn't kind of at odds with what it is. And it may not be good to link it always with the feminine, but mystery and darkness and unnameable may deserve some protection as that.
Hmm. Yes, Liam.
Just sort of in response to that a little bit, the feminine is... historically, and especially in very, very ancient cultures, was always linked with the moon, which is sort of a very dark kind of mystery. There is a lot of like mystery around the feminine. So I don't know if separating the feminine from that kind of dark, mysterious energy makes an enormous amount of sense to me, because it's always been linked, historically and canonically and mythologically with that kind of sort of darker, more mysterious power, in terms of the moon sort of being reborn every month. And there's a lot of mythology about the feminine and sort of the goddess kind of energy being this kind of symbol of rebirth. So it's those two things are one and the same. So I don't know if it makes...
I'm sorry, what two things are one and the
same? Well, the feminine and this kind of like mysterious... this sort of idea of like mystery and sort of depth and things like that. Those
And how do you link that to the figure of the nun in this story?
Well, I mean, I think that personally it would be kind of nice to, if some of these stories, and it's a problem I have with some stories of Buddhism, is that a lot of the times it's just the nun, the bhikkhuni, you know, there is never anyone named. I don't know if that's what the story is doing, trying to link that sort of feminine energy with this kind of mysterious kind of depth of the feminine kind of goddess qualities that existed in India at that time. I don't know if they're linking it to sort of Durga or Kali or anything like that. I would personally kind of doubt that they are. So I think in terms of a Buddhist perspective, I would sort of agree. I would like to have a little bit more context about who this person is. You know, who is this wife, mother, bhikkhuni person? I don't think it necessarily needs to be just this mysterious sort of other. I find that oftentimes in Buddhism, that kind of othering of the feminine can be kind of dangerous in a way. That kind of like othering of like, you know, the monastics kind of live by themselves and they have nothing really to do with women at all. But that, I don't know, I find that that can be dangerous because then you're sort of like, there's a whole realm that you're not exploring, that you're not taking in, that you're not open to.
Mm-hmm. And so before we go deeper into that story, because it's also the longer one, what about this first one, the traders of Sariva? What did you find there? In one sense, it's a very kind of straight, you know, very simple story, but there's actually quite a bit in it. Yes, Vito.
One of the things I find interesting about it is that, the quote unquote mean trader, like he doesn't recognize that the bowl is gold, right? But the Buddha does.
Yeah, he does. He sees right away that it's gold, and he's pretending.
Oh, right,
right. He doesn't
want
it because he wants to get it for nothing.
Okay, yeah, I remember that now. I just, because I was going to say that it's a metaphor for enlightenment. I guess this is the price that you pay for. Like it's a priceless thing, but you don't really necessarily know what it's worth until you have it, I guess. I was thinking that if he didn't realize it, then like it's kind of not his fault, but I don't know, I guess I misunderstood that.
If he didn't know that it was gold, you mean?
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, so what do you make of here in the beginning, he says, if you give up your practice, so he's telling this story to a disheartened bhikkhu so that he can persevere. And he says, if you give up your practice in this sublime teaching, which leads to nibbana, you will suffer long like the trader of Sariva who lost a golden bowl worth 100,000 coins. So that's the setup for the story. And then this story is told where essentially he loses his life. So how do you understand that? You or anybody?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, like part of practice is to be kind and fair and honest and in that moment, maybe in that moment at least, we don't necessarily know about the rest of his life. He turned away from those qualities and he lost like the literal wealth that he might have had coming to him otherwise. In the same way that if in a particular moment we decide it's not worth it to take the higher path, so to speak, we're losing out on, you know, awakening.
Okay. Yes, Nolan.
I actually really like this story, because I can can definitely relate with the trader who kind of explodes on the shore. I've definitely experienced that kind of like feeling of trying to like weasel my way into something and then missing out on it. And someone else gets all the goods. And as far as my practice goes,
how do you understand the fact that he could have offered them 3 coins and they would have taken it because they had nothing, or a trinket, like they were asking for it, but he wanted it for nothing. He wanted it free, basically. How do you understand that?
Well, at least like in my life, it's kind of embarrassing to say, but I've always, I think one of the reasons I've given up on so many things is like when I don't get it right away, like this idea of a prodigy, you know, and like, you know, hearing the story of Mozart that he like composed a symphony at age 3 or whatever, you know, and when that doesn't happen for me, I'm like, oh, I have to work for it. Like that sucks. Like I don't want this anymore. So I definitely understand that feeling of like wanting something, like something of great value for, and like trying to get it for nothing. I definitely know that feeling of trying to finagle that. You know, that's a familiar feeling. And it doesn't feel good. No, it definitely doesn't feel good. And hearing the other side of the story of the guy who of the Buddha's part, who when he realizes what it is and is like, well, I can give you everything that I have, you know, that I can definitely relate that to my practice. You know, it's like I've been saying this, you know, it's like it feels a lot like this practice and like my meditation and like living here is like it asks for everything. You know, I can't like withhold something and like keep it as mine. You know, I gotta really let it all go, to feel that kind of, expansiveness, you know, in my practice. So I, you know, it's a really pithy story that shows, really intense sides, you know, of like, are you willing to give it all away for, you know, and he's giving everything he has, that is of equal value, you know, and he's gaining the bowl, you know, and it's like, what is he actually really giving up for this bowl? Mm-hmm. You know, it's all evened out in the end, you know?
Can I give her
the bowl is worth 100,000 gold coins. And he only offers 1,000, I think.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah. You're right. That is very true. That is very true. Yeah.
Steven.
You know, it's also interesting because they're both like they're well off peddlers. You know, I mean, neither of them are at least as far as I remember, they're not. You know, they're wealthy merchants. So
it says that they are selling fancy goods.
Yeah, so I'm assuming that they have some level of you know, wealth and financial power. So which I think just brings a weird twist to the story, because like, what is this really about? It's not about the bowl. I mean, yes, we know that the bowl is like priceless, right? But it's something, to me, it feels like it's something more than just gaining wealth. Because, I mean, the first peddler could have easily swindled them. It's kind of what Sean was pointing out, that like this bowl was already priceless, and whatever that he would have offered them, they would have taken for it happily.
Yeah, but I think that's, I think that's not an accident.
No, I don't.
So the greedy peddler, Devadatta, wants it for nothing. That's the thing.
Yeah,
because I thought about it the first time that I read it. It's like, well, why didn't he just like offer them any little thing? They would have taken it. He wanted it for nothing. And so what is that moment in your practice? You want it, but you want it for nothing. You want it free.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of leads into...
Wait. You said, yeah. What is that moment?
It's avoidance, I think, really.
Of?
Yourself.
How?
You're trying to take a shortcut.
From where to where? Like, what are you
avoiding? I think it could manifest in different ways, but, I think you really... I've never tasted nibbana, but I would, in my own practice, in my short stretch of practice, I know anytime that I've tried to like avoid certain things that are going on in my zazen or even in my own practice and relationally, like it doesn't, you don't get the treasure of the Dharma. It's blocked off from you. And that's, in a way, I guess, is another form of greed, because you think that, if I don't deal with this and I just meditate really hard or something like that, like then it's going to be good. That's delusion,
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think there's a more articulate way of saying what I'm trying to say. But
I think I know what you mean. You are talking about avoidance specifically. Okay. Anybody else? Yes, Christine.
It may be something like Shugen Roshi was mentioning last week. In 7-8, Solis talks about it, the spiritual bypassing, just to kind of piggyback on what I think Stephen's trying to say, about skipping over dealing with my issues and meditating my way to other states, feeling like I don't have to do the work, that the work is getting in the way of nirvana or of something far more pleasant than sticking around to manage my anger, manage my jealousy, manage my stuff. So, mm-hmm. That's something for nothing. It's, trying to avoid having to even haggle or give anything up. Mm-hmm. Instead, just jumping to the prize.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes is from by Ajahn Chah. If you give a little, you'll have a little peace. If you give a lot, if you let go a little, you'll get a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will be free. Yes, Scrap.
At the core of what I think you guys were trying to discuss was this question of, is anything ours at all? Can we claim anything to hold on to? But also in the story, this question of the deceit, being completely unwilling to offer anything but wanting to, mm-hmm. deceive, and it brought to mind something that happened to me last week that had a more positive outcome, and that I have storage units, and all I want to do is empty these storage units and get the things into good hands. So I'd run into a photographer that wanted an enlarger, so I invited him to the storage unit, and I was like, here it is, do you need this? And he said, oh, it was a lights focomat, and I had no idea that it was worth anything at all. And he said, I have no money. And I said, well, neither do I. And he said, well, you need to sell it. And I said, okay, take everything else. So I gave him all the rest of the darkroom supplies because he told me what I had. And I think that's a kind of a valuable thing to bring into this conversation. Mm-hmm. I don't know why.
And what you said, I like what you said first, that you said deceit, but before, do we own it at all? That this peddler basically feels entitled to this bowl, feels entitled to deceiving this, grandmother and the young woman, and feels entitled to get it for nothing. It's quite a bit of entitlement. It's entitlement on top of entitlement. Yeah, Josh.
What stands out most for me is that the greedy peddler actually didn't lose anything.
Except his mind,
well,
his life.
In the end, but yeah, this whole catastrophe comes from really the loss of nothing except for the idea of what he could have had.
Yeah.
I resonate with that, you know, this whole idea of, you know, I could have been doing this, I could have done that, maybe if I started earlier, or, you know, this whole critique of who I am and what I've could have been and how much wasted energy that is. Yeah.
Yeah. And what about the bowl? What about the bowl itself? So there's this grimy bowl that's been, you know, sitting on some shelf or something that turns out to be gold. This is not the first time that this kind of treasure appears in the story. So where's another story, well-known story, that has something like this? Yes, Julia. So how does it go?
Well, friends get together and have a good time, and this one friend is nothing, the other friend is wealthy and sews a jewel or gem into his coat so it'll have something. And then they go their way, and the friend who thought he had nothing just struggled the whole time. And they met up again, and his friend said, didn't you realize you had this jewel the whole time?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right, that's in the Lotus Sutra. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So this idea that you have this jewel, that it is right there, that is so close, either sewn into your sleeve or, you know, right there on your shelf, or year after year, it's right there in front of you, and you don't recognize what it is. And here the young woman and the grandmother don't seem to be, you know, going around looking for it. But it's so interesting to me, that line. So it's really brought to them, it's brought to their attention when the peddlers come, right? They come into the scene. And this line when she says, the good peddler comes and says, you know, this is worth a lot of money and I don't have this much money. And she says, well, but the other one was just here and he said it wasn't worth anything. He got angry, threw it on the floor and went away. If it wasn't valuable then, it must be because of your own goodness that the bowl has turned into gold. I thought that was such an interesting line. It's because of your own goodness that the bowl turned into gold. The bowl was gold all along, or was it? I really like that line. Yes, Vito.
I was just thinking that it's like they're almost unwilling to believe, like they're so... They can't believe that the trader might have tried to deceive them. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if it's because they wouldn't possibly think of doing that to someone else. So how could they consider someone doing it to them? Like,
and yet the young woman just before was saying, "Oh, but that trader was nasty, grandmother. This one looks and sounds very kind. I think he will take it."
Right.
So she noticed something.
But I think that. There's a difference between,
you know,
just being...
You always say nasty in Sanskrit.
I think there's a difference between being mean and then... versus being, like, actually, like, lying to someone, you know? Like, maybe he was just in a bad mood or something like that versus, mm-hmm. like, you know...
So you're saying that they're still willing, that the grandmother certainly is still willing to, in a sense... up to this point, later she actually flies at him, it says... But up to this point, that she's willing to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, or maybe it's just her way of you know, trying to get the other trader to take it. Like, oh, like you must have turned it to gold.
Mm.
Therefore, you should take it. Not like because if it was gold before, like maybe he would feel bad about it. So maybe she was trying to like convince him. Somehow.
I guess that's possible. I hadn't thought of that. Yes, Tom.
I really appreciate that people have brought up entitlement. And one of my experiences over the years here, you know, just not only being a white male, but my father had this way of really, he was always the president of this or that, and he would like really break into things and charm people and then get whatever they had. And when I was first here and other places in my life where nobody checked me on stuff, I wasn't thinking. I was always usually just getting what I wanted any way I could. And then, as I started to notice stuff...
Can I ask you a question right there? So you said this was before practice?
Well, it was before just starting to wake up when I lived in a poor area of a city, mm-hmm. and I had been raised like Jewish American Prince and then started to see some other things. And the process sort of started there and then was strengthened and deepened when practice started.
And did you see that that way of thinking in practice? I'm going to get what I want or what I need any way that I can. In your practice itself, did you see that behavior? Mm-hmm. How?
I just remember like it didn't work. Whether it was like a forum like this or... I just remember feeling like I crashed and I felt disconnected. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I'd spin off into leaving here and eating a pint of ice cream or some other behavior like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's bad in itself, but it was a running away from something not working.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the ways in which this can appear, and it's in the Vimalakirti Sutra, it's those moments where we think we want the Dharma, or we want, let's say, liberation, we want freedom, but really our behavior is going for something else. So that passage in the Vimalakirti Sutra where Shariputra is really worried because all of these thousands upon thousands of arhats and bodhisattvas are coming in to his little hut. And he looks around and there isn't enough room for them. And he's thinking in his mind, is like, where's everybody going to sit? And I think it's Manjushri who reads his mind and starts berating him and says, Shariputra, did you come here for the Dharma or did you come for a chair? Did you come for the Dharma? Did you come for this? Did you come for this? Did you come for this? And he goes through a whole litany of things, basically saying to him, why are you worried about where everybody's going to sit? If the most important thing that you're here for is the Dharma, then trust that. But how many times, certainly I know how many times in my practice, I would say to myself, "That's yes, I'm here for the Dharma," and really I was there for... what I was practicing in that moment was something else. And I think that's the dichotomy, and it appears because that's what you get. You get the chair, and then you sit down in it and you realize, oh, that's not very satisfying, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know? Or you get mm-hmm. the ice cream, and it's like satisfying for 5 minutes, and you're like, oh, right, that's not really what I was mm-hmm. looking for.
And then there's the flip side of it that I was coming around to, that more... in the past few years, sometimes I'll be like getting in line for interview or wanting to talk to somebody, a senior or something, and I'll see another Sangha member initiate and be there and talk to the person and have the few minutes with them. And then sometimes I feel lost because it's hard to gauge where initiative and some assertiveness is appropriate and right-sized. And I'm not complaining about that. It's really a really good curriculum for this time, especially as a white male at this time and place in history, to have that pause and to wonder about that here or anywhere in my life. Mm-hmm. And then I'll experience all that jealousy and self-doubting when I didn't initiate. So finding a place that's appropriate and right-sized is something. Feels valuable somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The gorilla and her grandmother got 100 times less than their bowl was worth.
Yeah, I know. Sean pointed that out.
I feel for them. I wonder why they chose to give so little to the Buddha, to give to them, whoever wrote this story. And I'm thinking...
Yeah, and he happily goes off. You know, he's in his little boat, and he's like, you know,
he doesn't
goodbye.
Say, I'll come back.
I know. I noticed that.
They were so gracious about it. They could have said, oh, well, thanks for the information. I'll wait for the merchant
right.
who has the money.
Right.
I also, after your comment, I noticed that they weren't named at all.
No, they weren't either. Yeah.
We don't know what they were reborn into.
Right.
So in a way, it's like they were serving to the Buddha. They
yeah.
were giving him the opportunity to be kind.
Yeah,
and then they just. Poof.
Yeah, and what about this line? All of these end like this. He lived a full life, spent in generosity and other good deeds, and passed away to fare according to his deserts. What do you make of that? It seems like a standard line, which I hadn't seen before, but all three of these have it. What do you think that means? Yeah. The honest trader returned to Sariva, where he lived a full life, spent in generosity and other good deeds, and he passed away to fare according to his deserts.
Okay. Well, I think that you could argue that, you know, then in historical times when Devadatta tried to kill the Buddha, that was his just deserts. I mean, that the Buddha created that in this story.
Oh, that the Buddha created that? Huh.
Well, you know, they start this story and they travel together, they work
right.
together, they've divided things up, they have this deal where you go take that half, and then when you're done with that half, then we can switch and I can go do it again. Like they have, like they're kind of partners.
Yeah.
And then
something happens.
He just leaves him, and
that's so interesting. Yeah, exactly.
And he doesn't
like
take
he just
care
leaves
of
him at
Devadatta.
The end. Yeah, that's a very good point. It reminds me. I was telling somebody earlier of Shantideva. Hojin and I talked about it in our retreat. There's that passage in Shantideva where he's basically saying, "If you hurt me, I basically now have bad karma because I gave you the opportunity to hurt me." Right, so he completely turns it on its head. It's like, now I'm the one who has to atone because I gave you the opportunity to hurt me. You know what I mean? It's basically what you just said. It's like the Buddha now created the beginning of this bad karma for the Devadatta. That's so interesting. I hadn't thought about it this way. But I did notice, I thought it was a little weird at the end that there's a frustrated trader. He's just standing on the riverbank and he's having a literal, you know, heart attack. And the honest trader just, you know, he just kind of rides off into the sunset. I thought that was a little weird. Yeah. Yes, Mukuro.
I'm not sure if it makes any sense, but I was just thinking about in terms of the money and being satisfied with the small amount. And I thought the money is the Dharma. And there's 100,000 or infinite value, and they were given a small part of the enormity of the Dharma, and that was sufficient.
But why was it sufficient for them?
they were not greedy. They were just, there was a dharma. There was this sufficient amount of money. They didn't need more. Hmm. And so that sense of losing out is still grasping. And they weren't grasping.
Yeah, and I think that's true. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, Kish.
I feel like it's a fairly basic teaching, but about the nature of greed and how much a poison it is. And reflecting on this seemingly simple story, I look at today's 1% and the trading class that we've grown up to sort of worship as the epitome of our most successful part of our culture. And these are people who've taken really good companies and gotten them over a barrel, but with deception and trading tricks, and then taken advantage of them and used their own, like, workers' pension funds to buy them out with and stolen all those funds from people. These are people who are so talented and brilliant and rich that they could have a very good life with a lot of wealth without making all those people miserable. Mm-hmm. But they turned down that opportunity, just like this trader did. His heart grew hot and blood gushed from his mouth.
Mm-hmm. The founder of Oracle, I said Larry Page?
Ellison.
Somebody asked him, like, however many billions he has, and somebody asked him, you know, when is it going to be enough? And he said, well, just a little bit more. Just a little bit more.
That's so transparent.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought so greed and jealousy, because that the jealousy is really, you could say, becomes Devadatta's legacy. So if this is the root of it, that is what continues, and it keeps propelling him from lifetime to lifetime, trying to get what the Buddha has, and constantly failing, of course. Okay, what about the pregnant doe? One of the things that I noticed right away in this story is just some of the language. Right at the beginning, you have a daughter of a wealthy merchant who had been uninterested in frivolous things. And we don't know what the frivolous things are, but we can fill in. And it says, unlike other girls her age, she was disgusted by the usual career of marriage and motherhood and wished to become a bhikkhuni instead. And a couple of lines later down, because she can't do that, she agrees, first of all, to get married and becomes a devoted wife, living a life of goodness and virtue in her new home. But just a few lines up, she was disgusted by this. So what does she have to do in order to become the devoted wife and be good and virtuous in her own home? I was wondering. Or anything else. Yes. Right.
It's kind of a short reply, but I think disgust is oftentimes delusion. I mean, to look at the processes of a lifestyle and to say that this thing, for whatever reasons, I'm sure she had many as to why it might be disgusting. I think that we oftentimes fail to recognize where maybe our own fear is in a situation we're disgusted with, or that we have so much anxiety about, or there's too much unknown in the idea of exploring such a lifestyle that it may as well just be disgusting, because it's an easier thing to turn away from. And then if we have concepts of what a noble life is, I mean, all the easier. So, and then I also think for her to be virtuous and good, I mean, you don't fake virtue. You are virtue. And so she truly had to be virtuous. She truly had to be good, I think, to really be able to explore that life to be endeared to it. So yeah, I think it's delusion.
Elizabeth, did you have?
I was only going to say that I think it's probably true of a lot of people's lives, and probably especially women in the past, that you don't get a lot of choice necessarily, whether that's through, you know, economic uncertainty in the past or sort of a sense of obligation to your family, and whether that's like that you will get married or, you know, later on if you'll look after your family, and that the way you approach the reality of your life as it unfolds is just because you don't like the idea of something doesn't mean that you should go into it with negativity and carry that disgust forward. Hmm. It's like if you can embrace what happens, you can be a good mother or daughter or carer, and it doesn't matter that those aren't the things that you might have aspired to. And I was going to say something similar to Riley, that if she had aspirations to a spiritual life, you can still find that in the day-to-day. It's how you approach the task or the situation that you find yourself in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe she was just trying to be nice to her husband so that he would let her become a bhikkhuni. Because she goes into it saying, after I am married, I will get my husband's consent to become a bhikkhuni. So she has a plan. Eva, are you going to say something?
Yeah, kind of to Riley's point, something I was talking to some of the other residents about this in the Theragatha also, is it seems like in a lot of these Pali texts, disgust is often evoked as a kind of help in practice, to be disgusted by the body. And, you know, what I was saying to the people I was speaking with about it is that I think in our time, this is not necessarily very skillful. At least for me, it doesn't feel skillful. You know, I think, like, especially in my experience for, like, women growing up now, disgust at the body, this kind of, like, you know, as she says, like, the body is made up of 32 parts. What is the point of adorning it? Comes from a bloody womb. Like, all this kind of, you know, I think we already get that in such a kind of negative, unhelpful way that mm-hmm. the rhetoric of that, like, means something very different to us or strikes us very differently than it seems like the author of these texts meant it to. And, like, I think when it says she's disgusted by the usual career of marriage and motherhood, you know, the strong emotion of disgust, I think, needs to be evoked because of a time when marriage and motherhood had such a kind of uncomplicated high value that now, I think, is more complex. And it seems like to me the way I would put this, you know, the way that I imagine her is just like really genuinely not interested. Mm-hmm. You know, not that her, because I think if we think of it as really disgust, the way I experience disgust, then Riley's point about like, yeah, it seems like aversion, you know, whereas like, I think if we take this character kind of at face value of what that she really wants, what she wants, you know, that she wants to become a bhikkhuni and that she doesn't want to be married, but she agrees to it as a kind of intermediate step, it makes more sense to say, you know, a kind of maybe indifference or, you know, disinterest rather than disgust.
Mm-hmm. And I'm always curious when I read, you know, passages like that that describe the body in very kind of negative ways, whether any of you have, you know, any kind of current modern practitioners, have you ever done that? Have you ever done any of the meditations where you really go through the body and see it oozing and filled with pus and blood and all of that? You have. Can you say a little bit about that? Can somebody give Ben a mic?
Well, just early on in my introduction to Buddhism, I was introduced to a kind of, I don't think it was Mahayana, but a kind of meditation on the body decomposing mm-hmm. after you die. Yeah. And it's different than what you're saying, but I think that is a useful tool. It brings you up really close with the whole bag of flesh and bones that we are and what it's going to be when we die. And it helps you put in perspective that
this face we look at in the mirror is not the self, it's not I, it's a body that's a part of the whole physical environment. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's in the Satipatthana Sutta, in the whole section on the body, there's a whole series of meditations on the decaying body and in charnel grounds and, you know, going all the way to death. But I've never done them. I've never done them myself. Yeah, Scrap.
On both of those points, I think she gave up a fixed idea of what she was offended by. And then, you know, what she could be hurt by or what she was willing to do. But also on this question of the disgust of the body, and this could be me projecting my own experience, it most definitely is, but maybe they were referring to something from another time related to what came up in the last study session about people getting wrapped up in being born into a super sensuous reality and believing that that's where that was the place to be, so that some of these descriptions that we're translating now and feel very kind of gruesome and degrading are warnings against that. So that's what the rejection of the body is, not necessarily a more modern mm-hmm. interpretation.
Yeah, you know, we got an image, an email from Shugan Roshi, who's in India, and he sent some pictures. And he said that he was starting to understand why so much of the teachings that really come down from Hinduism to Buddhism and to us are so focused on the senses, because he said something like, your senses here are completely saturated. And so he immediately noticed that himself. Yeah.
Just when you were talking about has anybody done that meditation on the body, I feel like there have been times in my life when I've been encountering the body, and my practice has really been to not turn away from what that is, that fetidness of my breath, say, or some sort of oozing sore. But you reminded me of an experience that I had, I think, a few years ago. We were doing art practice, and I made a commitment to just go out and, like, drop myself somewhere and draw whatever I saw. And so I went out back, and I plopped myself down in the grass, and I opened my eyes, and right in front of me, like a foot and a half, was a writhing, decaying, like squirrel body. With, like, you know, all those things.
I mean,
it
was still alive?
No,
or
it
writhing
was quite
because
dead,
it had stuff in it.
Yeah, it was a very lively spot. I mean, it was just like crawling with things and completely like open, and there was the face and there was the mouth, and it was just like I had such a wave of disgust. And then I was like, all right, this is your commitment right here. Open your book, take out your pencil. And it was it really showed me something about, like, facing what's, you know, what my senses are giving me in that moment, right, and how hard that is, right, and in a sense, what an edge that is for my own, like, ability to embrace reality and be present mm-hmm. with what's happening. So.
And I just wanted to say, kind of going back to the you know, just women, you know, at the time, and even, you know, up until contemporary times, Deepa Ma, her story is very similar. I mean, she wanted to study the Dharma from, it sounds like, the time practically she just popped out of the womb, and that her demeanor and her expression was clearly that's what she wanted to do. But, you know, she was born into a traditional family. She had an arranged marriage with a very kind man, apparently, she says, who still said, you know, no, you can't become ordained. And so she had to wait until he died. She never became ordained. She was a lay, she eventually became a lay teacher, but and had to go through the stories that we hear so often, the death of at least one, maybe two, children, and the death of her husband. So it wasn't really until, I believe, her 40s that she started practicing, and from wanting to do it from the time she was, you know, 3 or 4. So this was very common. It's in the Tarigata poems as well. So it's definitely a pattern that, you know, that so many women went through. And so she tells the husband, you know, he's basically like, you know, why aren't you like all dressed up? And so she says this about the body, and he just says, oh, okay, we'll go and become a bhikkhuni, like just like that. But then it says later that he was, you know, when the other bhikkhunis are taking her to Devadatta, they're like, well, he was reluctant, but he doesn't seem reluctant at all. You know, and of course these stories, it's like, you just get these snippets, you know, and you know, you either fill it in or you don't. But you know, so she's gone through this whole thing, and she's gone through the marriage, and now she's pregnant, and she's not. I guess in this moment, she's not being the good devoted wife. So he complains. She gives him a teaching, and he says, "Okay, you know, go and become ordained, and I will help you." Not only that, he says, "But I will help you." And so I just noticed that. I don't know how long they were married, but all of a sudden he just turns and says, okay, you know, let's do this. And then she gets into trouble because she's pregnant. And so what do you make of that whole section? You know, she's coming in, she becomes ordained, but she's pregnant, and now they're doubting her virtue. And there's this whole thing. What do you think of that? Yes.
One thing about that passage really struck me. It's like, well, she wasn't getting dressed up, and so he lost interest. He was like, all right, you know, on to the next. I'll help you. Let's just, like, clear
the slate.
Oh, really?
That was
the feeling that I got.
I think it also speaks to kind of, like, the kind of difference of home leaving for men and women. You know, it's like we have so many stories of, you know, like, last time we talked about those two friends who kind of go to this festival and think about mortality and then instantly go out and become ordained and, you know, achieve enlightenment within like a week. Whereas like the sense of for her, like she's given what she wants. She's able to be ordained, but not really able to cast off the life of wife, being a wife and a mother. Mm-hmm. You know, even just kind of logistically, that for women to have children was so much more kind of like direct, you know, that men seem to leave their children and wives behind much more easily than this woman is able to leave her son and husband behind in these stories. Yeah, I think it's a kind of, right, yeah.
Yes, Stephen.
It is important to note, though, that it's Devadatta who's right now in charge of her fate, which we know to be the antagonist. And he's, you know, it says something along the lines of where he's basically just concerned about his reputation and not about, which obviously means he's not concerned about her at all. It says something like he's not filled with compassion and generosity or lacking. Not being a Buddha and lacking generosity and compassion, Devadatta figured that rumors that one of his bhikkhunis was pregnant might cause him damage.
And why is this whole thing even there? Why is she pregnant? Why is she going in? Like, why is this whole section even there? I kept wondering. I mean, it feels, as I think Vito said, who said, you know, in the last story, that they're there to give Devadatta and the Buddha, again, the stage. And so he's the mean one who's only concerned about himself. And he's really not that great in this either. I mean, he's just saying, well, let's call it a trial, basically, because I can't just defend her because nobody is going to believe me. And so, you know, it's like, once again, they feel a little bit like props to me.
Yeah, I mean,
she feels like a prop.
I think that's what's extremely troubling about the stories. You know, they're not rounded characters at all. I mean, they're very flat. I mean, she's a little bit more developed, I think, than you know, because we at least know that from the very start she has this aspiration.
Right.
And regardless of how we interpret it, I mean, there's dissonance throughout her whole life up until this point. So there's some sense of humanity in her, but, you know, I mean, lacking a name and basically being a, like you said.
And then she gives birth to Kumara Kashyapa, who becomes famous as a preacher of the Dharma.
Yeah.
And we still don't know who she is.
Yeah.
They both become arhats, but we still don't know who she is. But we know him.
Yeah. It's there's just no,
it's like in the Hemingway stories, there, you know, yeah, there's a guy and then, well, there's a main character and then there's the girl.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, archetypal.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, I again, especially in the context of the earlier tale of the traitors, just think that the feminine comes out so much stronger and cleaner and brighter than even the Buddha. And it, I mean, I can see the problem with the kind of masking, the ghosting mm-hmm. of the feminine, mm-hmm. but the woman and the daughter in the traitor tales are definitely the most compassionate. They have nothing, and yet they're the ones who are sufficient. And in this tale as well, there's this aspiration, and yet it's so fluid and powerful that it just triumphs everything. And it sort of lets these other things happen. But I find it very easy to see the figure as ground and the ground as figure, especially when the feminine portion seems to be the place where all the good stuff originates and culminates. So I wouldn't want that to be the only way to see these, because I think we do have trouble with that kind of notion of the feminine then being just you. Everything else can be written upon it, mm-hmm. and it can be minimized and, mm-hmm. and eliminated. Mm-hmm. That's the peril there. But, you know, and I think this is, I'm going to have to go back and reread all the Jatakas now, because I can't think of a case in which the women are really the bad people.
I just want to just appreciate Fusho's readings of these stories. I think it's so interesting. I mean, I think all of the readings are interesting, but I think it's so helpful to see how it's possible to recuperate a story, and you know, that every story is about power, and that there in reading stories in different ways, there's ways of sort of recouping or, you know, shifting things around and not having it be so one-dimensional. And I just appreciate sort of, that was a very alternative reading that I had not considered in both stories. And, you know, I mean, I think there's a danger in making the feminine sort of one-dimensionally good. Nevertheless, I think it's a powerful sort of rereading of the tale. You know, as opposed to just reading like women are just like objects to project a story onto with nothing. So I just think it's a really interesting thing to talk about these stories and hear all of these different ways that people, mm-hmm. you know, that they're so open, I guess, is what I think is interesting.
And this is why we're still talking about them in 2,500, almost 3,000 years later. Yeah.
I guess I just had noticed she had an aspiration, and the path towards that aspiration wasn't exactly what she thought it might be. Hmm. So in essence, she gives birth to that which perpetuates the teaching to continue. Without really even intending to. And so it, I don't know, causes and conditions and all the things that happen, being perfect and complete exactly as they are, her life as a briefly devoted wife was, you know, very fruitful for all of us.
Mm. Eduardo, you had something? Yeah.
Yeah. I was much more moved by the deer than the people in the story. The stakes were so much higher. The Buddha almost seemed a little bureaucratic in this story. By, okay, let's just find someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas as a deer, he was willing to put down his neck.
Right.
And the child, the human child, seems he has dramatic importance, but nobody seems to care too much about him. He's like an obstacle. Whereas I felt like the mother deer really wanted to please spare my child, you know? It's like, kill me later, but let me bear him.
Yeah.
I was just really struck by something while we were just talking, in terms of intention, in terms of this character whose name we don't have, but whose aspiration we do have. And the statement that she made, like, why dress it up? Because it's just come out of a bloody womb anyway. In a sense that here she is now about ready to open her bloody womb and give up a life, you know, out to the Dharma, that there's something about that aspiration that I feel like is carrying. And it's almost like hidden, but there it is. Her life, mm-hmm. What she's living.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. And so then there's the section of the two deer kings, and they're supposed to be the Buddha and Devadatta again. And he is very much, you know, the embodiment of selflessness and of compassion. And I have a version of this story that I don't remember who illustrated, but it's very beautiful visually. It's very beautiful, and there's this and the way that one is written, it's even a little more dramatic. This sense of, you know, the deer kind of offering themselves from one herd and the other, and it's at least according to the story, doing so willingly, you know, to save one another. And I have a strong sense of sangha, and that although there are two herds, and although King Sakka, right, is still, you know, protecting himself, that they're very much one body, and they're trying to really do the unimaginable, you know, to it actually made me think, maybe because I've been working on this, of human sacrifice. You know, the Aztecs, to be sacrificed was an honor. And I was reading somewhere that sometimes, you know, there would be some kind of war, prisoners would be taken, and they would be forgiven. And they would get indignant. It's like, no, you're supposed to sacrifice me. Because it was such an honor to be given as a gift to the gods for the sake of harvest and for the sake of the land, for the sake of your people. So it made me think of this. And the Buddha really here, you know, so he not only spares his own life, but then he uses this as a teaching, right? And so he gets the king to spare everyone, all of the animals, and then the deer start eating the crops, and then so he goes and talks to the deer and says, "Well, you can't do that." And so I was thinking, like, what is anybody eating by that point? Because they're not really, you know, everybody's been spared. But this sense of, and I've seen it in other Jataka tales. So there's he uses his power, he uses his position, his power, and his example to turn the king, right, to give him a teaching. But then he really is kind of pushing it. Well, if you'll save me, how about them? And how about them? And how about them? And he just keeps enlarging it. And I don't remember if there's other Jatakas where, I don't think so, where the king says, well, no, that's too much. You know, this is only as far as I will go. That it is that generosity and that selflessness is met step by step with the same degree of selflessness and generosity from the other side. And wouldn't it be nice if that was always the case? You know, that there seems to be no friction, you know, no holding back from both ends. And then there's that line where the mother, the doe, is telling her fawn, death in Nigrodha's company is preferable to the longest life with Sakka. So death with the Buddha is preferable to the longest life with Devadatta. We could also say death in clarity, death in virtue, in compassion, is preferable to the longest life that is lived in service of just yourself, you know, your own greed. And then there's the same line, you know, in the P2, passed the king, passed away to fare according to his deserts. So anything else about this story?
I was wondering if it was promoting vegetarianism. Mm. It seemed like an early, this is what you should not eat.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder that too. Except I don't know what the deer are eating after this.
Well, they eat the forest.
I guess, yeah, right.
I also just wanted to thank Fusho for what she said, because I was getting annoyed with these stories and how they were reproducing this kind of patriarchal structure that existed at that time. And, the Buddha's the king in this story and in that story and so forth. And, you know, even in what you just said about the deer advising the fawn, saying, you know, it's better to live a life, you know, with the Buddha. The females are this voice of wisdom, right? And the male characters are just, they're battling it out, right? Well, we've got to call a council and weigh this out, whether or not it's going to be shameful, and we're not sure. Whereas, you know, the woman is like, I'm completely clear. I know I need to be here. You guys are arguing about something that's really actually irrelevant, right? But she's like, my aspiration's totally clear. I'm here, you know. So just to amplify, I think that was very great insight.
Right, thank you. Okay, so then what about the last story, the case of the gnawed leather? It was while staying at Jetavana that the Buddha told this story about acting for the good of relatives. And then he goes into this story. So, yes, Stephen.
I really enjoyed this story. There was one reading that I gave it where I kind of saw a semblance of the caste system within this story, and talking about how like class creates these false ideas and exceptions to law, and how the Buddha so cleverly revealed the truth. And I thought it was a very fun story, but I really liked how, you know, it was automatically assumed that the sort of vagrant stray dogs were immediately thought to be the ones that would have gnawed the leather, when really it was his closest cohort of dogs. And I took that as to be somewhat allegorical to the caste system and the sort of, I think, beautiful idea in Buddhism that, like, no matter what level of the caste system or wherever you are as a human being or any being, dog or man or, you know, you still have this preciousness, this sacredness, this life to be saved. That was... Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's just because it's been on my mind, but I read it as it's very easy to, like, jump to blame others or criticize others, but normally, and often that stuff is the stuff that you're doing yourself and in your own mind, or sort of, I tend to see when I criticize others, it's normally stuff that I don't want to admit that I do. Mm-hmm. So I sort of saw this as a little bit like that. He's rushing to blame the other dogs, but it's really the dogs in his own mind that are doing that, like, not in his own mind, but, you know, in his own backyard that are the ones to blame. So it's like, don't look out there, look here, look inside for the source of the problems with the world.
Yeah, like that Lojong slogan, turn all blames into one, which is basically saying turn it in, which you could misuse, and you could then just push yourself down. But what that really is saying is turn it. Don't turn the blame out, because that will never end. Turn it to where you can actually do something about it. And also, what about the kind of the mismatch? So his leather things are chewed a little bit, and he says, "Kill all the dogs." I mean, the expression, really, to me, of rage and of violence. He doesn't even investigate. It's just kill them all, you know. And the blanketness of that, and the power, how he's using his power, you know, to just eliminate, you know, since anything in front of him.
Doesn't that feel a little bit like anger, though? Sometimes when I'm angry, it does feel
exactly
something so small.
Exactly.
The amount of anger is, yeah, disproportionate.
My mother used to say, first I kill, then I investigate. Exactly like that. Yeah. And unfortunately, that's exactly how she operated. Yeah.
Well, and I don't know about 2,500 years ago or when these stories were written, but dogs in India are not the friendly pets we have here. They're not loved. They're not cared for. They're kicked and they're tortured. Still, so that the story focused on dogs and setting them free, and this decree to not kill dogs. Mm. Was made. I'm wondering what the message is there. So I just find it interesting that dogs were the focus, and not another animal. Because you could have turned the story in any way. But
yeah,
I find that to be interesting.
Yeah. Yes, Griffin.
So I mean, I understand that in this circumstance, it's sort of a reaction of rage towards these animals. But I think it kind of reflects even on ourselves and our own practice. Like, for example, a lot of monasteries I've seen, there's mouse traps everywhere. I mean, how big is that gap? I mean, sure, I don't like this animal. This animal's not okay. This animal is okay. But how different is it? You know, this is not on leather. This is, they broke into the pantry. Killing is killing.
Yeah, and so, what about that? What are you saying in terms of it being in a monastery?
I guess what I'm saying is, you know, we should sort of turn this back on ourselves a little bit and kind of examine.
Oh, that's the whole point of these stories, all
right
of them.
Right, yeah. But I'm just bringing this particular instance up because nobody's mentioned it.
The killing the mice.
The mice or anything. We, you know, use insecticides, all these kind of things, yeah.
Yeah, yes. Yes, we do. Yeah. Hey, Eve. Constance, would you mind just passing it?
An anecdote that just occurred to me because of the anecdote you brought up, Griffin, is what the cat we had when I was young, her name was Sheena. My dad would tell the story of how he had found the cat. He was hiking on Overlook Mountain, which is where the Tibetan monastery is, in the winter, and he found a little kitten out in the snow. And he went into the monastery to ask if it was their cat, and they said, no, the cat had been killing mice in their basement, and they didn't want any killing in their monastery. So they put the cat outside in the snow. And so, you know, I think just, you know, just to say that it's, there's killing we see and killing we don't see, and like it's not so clear as like, you know, in fact, I think it's actually a quite hard precept in some ways, not killing, because like, you know, the example of insecticides or mice getting into the pantry, like sometimes there's things you need, and you know, like it's hard. I think it's just like more, you know, the in the story, it's like very simple that the lives of all creatures in the realm be protected. Mm-hmm. I think it's harder to know, like, especially on the level of animals, like what that means.
Yeah.
Practically.
I kind of read that story really as such a contemporary mirror. I mean, I've read it at a first degree. I really, this idea of collective punishment is very active. I mean, it is a basis of so much injustice in the world today. Mm-hmm. It's happening all the time. I mean, we can think about of a lot of examples of, you know, to answer your question about why killing all the dog, it seems such a you know, excessive abuse of force, but we can think of a lot of examples today mm-hmm. of, mm-hmm. you know, how this collective punishments happens and happens all the time. I think the idea of a dog also, I tend to agree that I would have to think why the dogs, because dogs are pack animals, and they are probably not very high on the animal scales, and so it's easy to dehumanize them, you know, to just see them as a pack, as a, this anonymous mass of people that don't have, or animals that don't have any singular value. And yes, of course, I think what you, Stephen, brought up, the idea of the caste system, class system, the dog of the palace, you mm-hmm. know.
Yeah, he's protecting his own.
He's protecting them, his own. I mean, you know, and it's like the gutter dogs that have to, I mean,
and I wonder if kind of maybe that ties into what Elizabeth was saying. So he doesn't investigate before he decrees, okay, kill all the dogs except mine. Why doesn't he investigate? So that he won't see what he doesn't want to see, that maybe it is closer than he wants it to be. And then what about this passage where the dog is stealthily making his way into the city and he makes... And because of his kindly thoughts, he was able to reach the palace safely without encountering anyone. So he quite literally wraps himself in a protective field of loving kindness and the 10 perfections, it actually says. and he's stealthily making his way in this kind of cloud of loving kindness. You know, and that story that I mentioned before, Angulimala, it's a similar thing. So the Buddha is walking calmly towards, Nalagiri. He's walking calmly toward this raging elephant that has just laid this town flat. Everybody's hiding behind doors, behind windows, but they're all peeking out to see what's going to happen. And the Buddha and Ananda are walking together, and Ananda's petrified at seeing this raging bull running towards him, but he doesn't want to leave the Buddha alone. And he, in fact, says to himself, if I need to, I'll throw myself before him to protect the Buddha. And the Buddha is very just calmly walking, you know, towards Nalagiri. And then there's this moment where it is said that it's, at least the way that Rave Martin describes it, I actually haven't read the original or, you know, another translation, that there's kind of like this spiral, this force of loving kindness that hits Nalagiri on the forehead. And when we had the kids, you know, we were doing a storyboard, and so we had them draw it, and so many of them did this kind of kind of spiral of like superpower of loving kindness hitting Nalagiri. And so he never even touches him until afterwards. Once Nalagiri is down, he places his hand on his forehead and says something like, Nalagiri, no more killing. That's why he's no more killing. But in the moment, he stops him really by the power of his loving kindness. And that appears in a number of the other Jataka tales. And, you know, in the way that it's described, it sounds, you know, it seems a little cute to imagine the dog. And yet, you know, Karaniya Metta Sutta, you know, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. That these stories really are describing how such a person lives their life. And that this, you know, remember that when I mentioned in that talk the Lorica of St. Patrick, this sense of having a breastplate, a protection, a prayer of protection. You know, we don't use that language so much, and maybe because this is older, it's you know, unapologetic, but it is very much this sense of protecting your mind through the holding, the rising, the holding in your mind of these perfections. And I think that's is not just a narrative device, that this is really how Buddhists saw what they really saw was possible, you know, and what we actually have available to us. And so then, you know, he goes through his and first, you know, he questions the king, you know, what was the crime, if you will, and the king explains, and he says, so I'm punishing everyone. He says, but do you know, are some of them going to be spared? And he says, well, I'm sparing mine. But how do you know, right? And then he says, you are following four evil ways, partiality, dislike, ignorance, and fear. Such behavior is wrong and not king-like. When a king tries a case, he should be as unbiased as the beam of a balance. What you are carrying out is not the impartial destruction of all dogs, but rather the slaughter of the poor. Your majesty is not acting with justice. So it's actually a very direct, it's not hidden, it's not disguised at all, it's a very direct teaching. And once again, perhaps surprisingly, the king listens very carefully, because the king, it turns out, is Ananda. So he has enough karma, he has enough practice, he has enough openness and awareness to be able to take that teaching and turn towards wisdom. It would actually be very interesting if that was not the case and there was more of a thing, you know, where the Buddha had to convince him more or turn him or find another way to work with him, because isn't that what happens most of the time? It's like, you know, you see it in your mind, but no, I don't really want to. You see it and you fight, you know. I think it's, you know, not unheard of, but it's more rare that it happens so smoothly that you just turn and align yourself towards wisdom. And then he creates this demonstration to show, you know, who the guilty ones really are. What would that be? What would the equivalent be in practice? So there's this self-deception, really. There's what's closest to me, I'm not going to look at. I'm going to protect. And yet here, the Buddha creates a situation in which that is the fallacy of that is revealed. What do you think would be the equivalent of that in practice? What would you need to do to undeceive yourself? Yes, for sure.
I think eat a pint of ice cream.
Say so, more?
Yeah, so if we're practicing and we're not seeing something and we don't want to see it, one of the ways sometimes to reveal it is to just indulge. And then the stuff comes up more, and it's really hard to avoid seeing it. So, yeah, that's pretty direct.
All right.
I think one way to see it is every week, look at what you do on Hosan.
Does it say more?
A teacher here once said, practicing according to the schedule, the monastic schedule in residence is for failed lay students. Because we have so much support and so many ways in which our lives are kind of entrained into practice. But when Hosan comes around every week, we suddenly have open time and space, and we can make free choices. And that's when we see what's really going on.
Mm, okay. Yeah, Josh.
In my experience, seeing others engaging in something and having compassion for them opens up space for me to see my faults and have compassion for myself and work with that.
So it's really the example of others. Yeah. Eva, were you going to say something?
So both in this story and in the one where the bhikkhuni is pregnant, what's the evidence? So if I'm mad at somebody and I'm like, she did this, she did this, she did this, wait a minute. Where's the evidence that it's her fault and it's not me? And just really, well, the backward step, turning around. Is it me? So we can find out which dogs ate it. Make the dogs throw up. We can find out when she got pregnant by calculating. I mean, this is kind of looking at the facts, but the facts. Mm-hmm. What really happened?
Okay. I was just going to answer the question about what's the most immediate thing for me, and it's always people, seeing the face of another person. What's my impact? And I feel like there's a necessity of kind of going outside myself in mm-hmm. order to see into myself. Mm-hmm. It's kind of not so much about the model or the example of another person, but it's like often it's the hurt, mm-hmm. If I can see the hurt on another person's face, I can stop mm-hmm. My self-righteousness.
Yeah, I agree. I very much feel that that's the power. That's what we do for each other in Sangha, right? That when you can't see yourself and from inside, you can convince yourself really of almost anything, and you will if you want to. And it is really until you're willing or something happens to turn out and see the effect that can really shift. So I very much agree. Yeah. Yes, Stephen.
This is something I realized recently. I know now that when I'm justifying whatever I did, if I get these thoughts from justifying my actions, I know that I'm not looking at something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's it's a good kind of alarm. It's a good signal to have you look further.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Tyler.
I think about all the things that I want to do and that I'm too afraid to do, and how that fear is a protection from keeping me from doing what I love or what I believe in.
And how do you move past it if you feel it?
Painfully, slowly, right through it. I look for examples. People have done it. And I try to pay attention to ways I failed in the past and try to imagine success.
Okay. All right, anything else? And also, often in these stories, in both this one and the one with the deer, they give the king the precepts and ask him to be righteous and steadfast. And in this one, it actually says his teaching, so the dog's teaching endured for 10,000 years. And it very well might. You know, these stories, you know, sometimes if you read the Jatakas kind of quickly, they may seem, you know, sometimes a little simplistic, or like, oh, you know, nice stories for kids, to introduce kids to the Dharma. And really that there is so much in them. Really any kind of mythical story like these fairy tales, I mean, why do we still tell them? Because there is something so archetypal, somebody was saying, you know, in them that we recognize. And, you know, we just saw tonight how if you scratch even a little bit, there's different viewpoints from which to enter a story, which means there's different possibilities, and which to me also opens a further door for just further stories, and so that it doesn't actually have to become a cookie cutter. So so to me, that really is the power of a good story, of a powerful story, and also because that's what we remember, right? You know, the whether it's the stories of our childhood, the stories of our own lives, stories that people have told us, usually these are the things, unless they're very pithy teachings, you know, kind of sound bites. You know, the stories are the things that we remember. And I've always thought of them really as maps, you know, maps to navigate the sometimes perilous straits, you know, that make up a human life, that because people have been telling these for so long, and keep handing them down generation after generation, that there is something that also continues, which means there's something that continues to be true and that we continue to be guided by. So, thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.